The Art and Business of Craft. The making of furniture, ceramics, clothing, and other fine crafts has become a career for many Mainers, a hobby for others, and a source of community for all. Long before the emergence of the maker movement, the legacy of craft has been a major part of Maine's creative identity and reflects the state's vast supplies of natural materials. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll explore the connection between art and craft, the changes in selling trends, and we'll find out what people are making and where and how they're selling it. We'll also discuss the role of craft as an academic pursuit and learn more about a project at Colby College that connects students with highly skilled artisans and craftspeople. Maine Calling is next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The word craft can mean different things to different people. For some, it's an art. For others, it's a business. Often, it encompasses both. Today, we're going to learn about the art and business of craft in Maine. In the studio with us, Sadie Bliss. She's executive director of the Maine Crafts Association. Daisy DeRosier is program director for the Lunder Institute for American Art. And Jason Ryan is a founder and director at Open Bench Project. Thanks for joining us, all of you, today. Appreciate it. Sadie, we'll start with you. Maybe a little bit about this word craft so that we're all on the same page. Crafting described everything from, putting together pieces of felt with a hot glue gun that I do at home, to high-end furniture, to very artistic high-end pieces, to boats. It's a broad spectrum. When you use the word craft, does it usually mean like fine craft? Or what are we talking about?
Well, at the Maine Crafts Association, we strive to serve craft artists who are at all different levels and points in craft. So we have a Master Craft Artist Award program where we're really kind of seeking out and identifying artists who are at the top of their field and have shown nationally and internationally and mastered techniques and equipment and materials. And then we also find ways to include and highlight people who are just working in their homes, maybe just starting out. Maybe it's more of a side thing than something that they're focusing their life on. So craft tends to be defined by media. However, there's certainly a lot of overlap with art because a lot of times sculpture is a great example. Mm-hmm. It could be made out of anything, and one person's going to call it art, and one person's going to call it craft. So
you have a pretty broad constituency in terms of the organization. It's a big group.
Yep, we have about 600 members, and there's a lot of other craft artists in Maine who we work with or interact with in different ways that are not necessarily part of our membership.
Is it fair to say that, I mean, there are other parts of the country that might have their own kind of artistic identity or crafts identity? You know, the Ozarks might have their own legacy of crafts that's part of their cultural and historical identity. Does Maine have its own, or is Maine part of the New England scene?
Certainly Maine is part of New England, and there's certainly a lot of tradition of craft. There's Maine Indian basket makers that represent kind of the beginnings of those stories, and there's Shaker types of work. At this point, I would say there's influence from everywhere, and the traditions still exist, and also lots of new influences.
Yeah. Daisy, I'll bring you in here, and your thoughts maybe on Maine's craft identity, but also on this question. I want to start with this question that often comes up, which is, finding the line between art and craft. It seems to be an exercise that we like to do, can't help do. But is there a line, do you think, and should we be trying to find it?
Oh, I don't know if we need to find it, but it's definitely a place where arts and craft meet, intertwine, collaborate at times. And for some people, as Sadie was saying, craft and arts are one thing. For others, it's two different things. Those are definitions that are constantly evolving changing, and people or creative mind find their own definition and meets in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. Historically, you know, what we call maybe craft now was just stuff that was needed. You know, we needed to, a chair or a spoon. And is it now, though, more about design or making things that are aesthetically pleasing? Mm. Is that what we think of more as craft now?
Some might. I mean, at the Lunder Institute for American Art, we're really looking at collaborative initiative with highly skilled craft people going from woodworker, metal worker, potters, glassblower, and production studio with whom we want to engage our visiting artists or network of visitors passing through the museum or Colby campus. And so in this sense, I would say aesthetic is a place where they meet, and creative endeavor is definitely the place where ideas get to be developed.
And you're in this, you know, this very academic setting, Colby yeah. College. And is this an attempt to have a craft find a place or a role in that academic setting?
Well, yes, and to learn with our students and create opportunity for them to understand and see process. The idea of making being one that is really complex, rich, but unpacked through different initiative and different collaborative endeavor again. Right now we have this exquisite exhibition where we have the works of many basket makers from the Wewinikan community. But we're also excited with the Maker Map initiative, which I'll talk more about a bit later, to highlight the highly skilled material-based experts that are in Maine as a way to connect them with some of our visiting community, mainly artists coming from different places in the States as well.
All right, and we will come back and talk about that. But Jason, I want to come to you. You're the director of the Open Bench Project, and this is a shared studio and community space for makers, and I want to ask you the question about that word also, to come together and kind of help build community around this. But first of all, you're a self-identified maker, but explain what a maker is as opposed to just a craftsperson.
Boy, I don't know. That's a loaded question, I guess. I think they're similar. I think makers are people who bring ideas into some physical form. It's an equally broad term, kind of like craft. I guess I use it just as a way to indicate that I'm a person who takes an idea from just sort of a concept into that physical body. And I work with a ton of mediums to do that. It's kind of, for me, in some ways, it's irrelevant what the mediums are. It's a matter of just actualizing that idea as a maker.
And we have this, you know, historically, the image of the lone artist, the lone blacksmith, the lone potter, you know, sweating away at work in their studio. But this space that you're involved in sort of turns that upside down, and there's a philosophy behind it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think in some ways that notion of the idea belonging to a single individual is a bit outmoded. We all sort of gather information from one another, and we may push an idea slightly forward some, but ideas really should be attributed to groups and lines of thought more than that individual. So we, at Open Bench, we try to create a space where people can get together and just bounce ideas and feel safe saying that they want to try something that is undone or unthought of, or try to do something that's traditionally been done in one way and in a new way. And so we put a lot of work into just sort of creating that safe environment for people to open up and exchange ideas.
And the theory is that they would attempt things they might not otherwise do on their own.
Very much so. So one of the ways I explain it to people is I have a barn full of tools that are my own. And at my house, I can make almost anything that I could make down at the Open Bench. But the problem with my barn is that I only have my idea. But down at the Open Bench, I have a little bit of your idea. And so every time I go down there, I get introduced to something that I otherwise would not have thought of. And maybe it's appropriate from what I'm working on today, maybe not. Maybe it'll become appropriate a year from now. But I'm constantly being exposed to new ways of thinking and doing, which is really, really rewarding and enriching.
Can you, I'm sorry to put you on the spot, I should have asked you before, but can you give me an example maybe of something that emerged from the setting that you're talking about, a collaboration or a project that emerged likely because of the sort of the connections that you're talking about?
Sure. So one of our members does bowl turning on the lathe, and he has developed this technique that I find is really quite beautiful, which basically it comes out of sort of picking our trash pile. But he finds these scrap pieces of wood, and I've done a bunch of burning projects myself where I'll burn down a piece of wood and it raises the grain and sort of puts this weathered effect on it. And he was watching that and watching looking at his stuff, and just one day he's like, I'm going to try this finished thing that you're doing, but the way I was doing it wasn't really quite right. So then he grabbed this other technique that he saw, and so it sort of led him down this path of just trying a whole bunch of really mess around work that really didn't have any value on its own at the time, but it led him to now being able to create these really, really interesting pieces. And his favorite part is whether or not you can look at the work and understand how it was made. He really likes the line where you can't quite figure it out. So,
yeah. Sadie, are there emerging trends in craft in Maine now? Anything that's sort of moving to the fore of either interest or growth in terms of the amount of makers there are?
Well, there's trends with maker spaces, people kind of coming together for community needs, to build community and to share resources. As far as trends in media, I think that ceramic artists are still growing, and there's always been a lot of ceramic artists in Maine, but that's continuing, and having places like Watershed Center for Ceramic Arts to do more experimental work and community work adds to that and brings people from out of state. Also, the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance has done an amazing job of rebuilding their kind of emerging artists and next generation of artists. So that's sort of a new old trend. And then certainly there's trends bringing in non-traditional work into the definition of craft, including maybe things like robotics or even coding. In using unexpected materials or recycled materials or things that have to do with sustainability and trying to make the practice itself more sustainable environmentally.
So that's interesting. We tend to think of craft as, you know, being these sort of traditional things made of natural materials, based on the resources we have in Maine, the wood, the stone that some of this stuff came from. But you're saying there's a digital space for this as well?
Certainly. Sometimes it incorporates the old media, and sometimes it's totally new. So certainly, like, digital printing has found its way, and some people have resisted that, and some people have embraced it. Even the larger national craft shows mostly have embraced it now that a jeweler, their designs are made on a digital printer rather than by hand.
And you say there's been some resistance. Are there debates within anyone can jump in on this? Are there internal debates in the world of craft about what qualifies as craft and whether something is quote unquote manufactured or handmade? Is that central to this?
Oh yeah, I think it's age old. Each organization, each craft show, any group of artists probably discusses this constantly. If each component of the work is actually being made by hand, if somebody's helping, if they're buying a piece of it, if they're having any kind of outside assistance, what kind of tools they're using. And it can be challenging, but I think it's also really interesting. And there's ways to draw lines there that if you're, you know, you can create boundaries around, say, a craft show that you have to do things in this certain way to be in this certain thing. And I think that's okay.
Yeah. But online, you can just be who you are. And I guess the craft label doesn't matter as much. I mean, you can't say handmade, or can you, in the case of digital printing?
I don't know. I think some of that's arbitrary and based on everybody's individual preference. There are people who will, you know, there are some people who say, well, my grandfather would never do it that way. But I think if grandfather had a CNC machine, he would have used the CNC machine because, you know, they were probably using the technology that was best at the day. You know, grandfather used a hand plane and not a flint stone. So, right. You know, you can. There are some people who part of their process is romancing a particular technique or a particular medium. And I think that is totally valid. I think that's part of their exploration. I don't think that you can blanket statement the entire process for everybody.
Yeah. Daisy, I want to get back to the maker's map you mentioned earlier. So this is an interactive map that connects students or other users with skilled artisans, craftspeople. Talk about kind of how it works and the, I guess the theory behind it, or what you'd like the users to get out of it.
Absolutely. It's actually an initiative that we develop with students. So it's a research initiative that I oversee with them. It was initially, the idea was for us at the Institute, as we invite visiting artists, scholar, museum professional to engage across discipline on campus, for us to share also other communities that are based in Maine, such as the craft community, craft people. And so in working with students, what we've been developing, and also in collaboration with the Maine's Craft Association, is a platform. So it's an interactive map that identify and local and locates material-based expert builders and workshop. And the idea was just that all of our visitors, visiting artists, expert from the art world, would be coming and have access to this amazing network of knowledge of people who have been working with wood, either from a tradition perspective or an innovative perspective or somewhere in the middle. But as they would be visiting us for a research initiative, innovative collaboration, there was also this other platform that would allow them to meet and discover other workshops or structure that are such a great part of Maine's communities of makers.
So it hasn't launched yet. It launches next month.
Yeah, in late November, we're still kind of reaching out, connecting with people. And so if any woodworker, metal worker, potter, glassblower, production studios feels compelled, we're welcoming any submission, and they can reach us really easily through the Lunder Institute website. But it's an ongoing project right now. Yeah.
All right. We're talking about craft and crafting and crafts in Maine. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Diversions, Puzzles, and Games by Maine Mall. Committed to bringing people together with new and classic games and a variety of puzzles. DiversionsGames.com. And Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at BullMoose.com.
About a quarter of Americans retire on not much more than Social Security. That makes finding affordable senior housing a challenge.
From the first day that I moved in, my spirits were really lifted because where I'd been living before, it really was people just sitting there waiting to die.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story, plus the impeachment inquiry latest, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the authors of the new book, Border Wars, Inside Trump's Assault on Immigration. We talk with Julie Hirschfeld Davis and Michael Shear of the New York Times. They say Trump's goal is to make crossing the border terrifying. They report he even suggested a border moat filled with snakes and alligators. Join us.
That's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, The Art and Business of Craft in Maine. My guests are Sadie Bliss, Executive Director of the Maine Crafts Association. Daisy Desrosiers is Program Director for the Lunder Institute for American Art. And Jason Ryan is Founder and Director of the Open Bench Project. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Gabriel Frey. He's a traditional Passamaquoddy basket maker who earlier this year was awarded a prestigious United States Artists Fellowship. Gabriel, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you being on the program, and congratulations on the fellowship.
Thank you so much, Keith, and thanks for having me.
Can you talk about how the Wabanaki basketry tradition fits into the state's larger crafting tradition? It's part of its foundation, clearly.
Yeah. Well. Maine Indian basket making goes back, obviously, to pre-colonial times and, you know, has changed over the years. But it does not necessarily one because of the other, but it has been informed by the state. It has a prominent place in almost every sort of corner of Maine's history and industry, like from the fisheries. They used to use baskets in manufacturing pearlescence from fish scales, and in our agricultural fields, from apple picking to potato picking. Sort of, you know, the main potato basket is ubiquitous with that sort of field. But then also you look at the traditional hunting pack, right, from L.L. Bean, which is like almost a main character in and of itself. That's a traditional Wabanaki design.
So what is talk about, if you would, the fellowship and what this might mean for, how will it work, and what do you hope to bring to it?
The United States Artists Fellowship?
Yes.
Aside from being a national platform to gain recognition for Maine Indian craft, it's really helped me expand what I do, sort of taking off the pressure of just making things that sell and reproducing the same exact thing. I've had a little bit of breathing room to actually cross-pollinate and sort of explore other factors of creating, not just to put food on the table. So it's tremendous as far as breathing creative breath into work.
I wonder if you could also talk a little bit about your work and how it connects to your cultural identity.
Yeah, sure. So I do traditional Passamaquoddy baskets, which, you know, throughout our history have been utility in scope, but through, again, our connection with sort of the larger society, we started making more decorative pieces for sale to tourism and things like that to sort of help uplift the community. So carrying on that tradition, I mean, the Passamaquoddy creation story is centered around the black ash tree. So I think one of the other guests was saying that, like, what ties craft to a specific style or material. For us, black ash is that material. So sort of like maintaining a specific process around how we harvest the material. A lot of our legends and stories are transmitted through that action, through reproducing the same style.
Interesting. Well, again, congratulations on the fellowship. We appreciate it. And thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Gabriel Frey is a traditional Passamaquoddy basket maker. Sadie, I was going to ask you, do native artists' crafts, do they have their own kind of organization, or are they part of of yours? What's the connection between the larger craft community and some of the Native arts and crafts?
I would say it's both. There's the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance, which is an organization that is specifically for that type of work and those artists. And then the Maine Crafts Association, as well as most other craft organization in Maine, welcomes anyone from that group and has different programs and events that would incorporate them in one way or another. So in our organization, we have our retail craft galleries, and we sell Maine Indian basket makers through that. And right now we have tomorrow night we have an opening for the capstone exhibition of our craft apprentice program. And that's a program that offers seven-month apprenticeships. A master and apprentice work together for 7 months side by side, and then we show their work. So Gabe's work will actually be in that. He's a 2019 master in that program, and his apprentice is Francis Soctema. So that program is open to any artist working in any media, as it's most of our programming. So we don't have a preference one way or another for a ceramic artist or a basket maker, but we always try to make it possible that we could work with any media.
All right, on the line with us now, we'll bring in Paul Sakaridis, who's executive director of the Haystack Mountain School of Crafts. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So for those who of you have ever heard of Haystack, I think it's a pretty well-known institution with a history in Maine. But can you, I guess, talk briefly about the legacy of Haystack, of craft, in Maine, which, as I understand, is the focus of an exhibition currently at the Portland Museum of Art.
Right. So Haystack was founded in 1950, and so the school's coming up on its 70th anniversary this coming year. And this past year, an exhibition opened at the Portland Museum of Art. It actually just closed on September 8th. And it was called Haystack Mountain School of Crafts, it was called In the Vanguard, Haystack Mountain School of Crafts, 1950 to 1969. And the exhibition chronicled the first 19 years of the school from its founding in the Montville Liberty area, where it existed from 1950 to 60, and then for the first 9 years when the campus moved from Montville to Deer Isle proper.
So how would you describe, I guess, what Haystack was? What it was sort of this post-war generator of, what would you say, like contemporary craft? I mean, what was its role?
Well, I think that the term post-war is a really important term to use when talking about Haystack, because if we've, you know, I think we've covered a lot in this show thus far today, and one of the key areas is that when we try to define what craft is, it's a pretty slippery definition, and it's a really broad one, and it has many histories, and I think those histories need to be defined in order to kind of understand what we're talking about. And for Haystack, of coming out of a post-war evolution of craft, it was a time where traditional craft-based disciplines of clay, wood, metal, glass, and fiber began to be used by artists in a way that was separate from industry and being used in individual studios, and had a basis in both utilitarian and functional wear, and also a way of being thought about in a broader scope of art and design more broadly. And so when Haystack was founded, it was really this experiment. It was an idea of beginning a school that would celebrate craft in Maine, of a way to have a sense of community and purpose for people to explore ideas together. But most importantly, it was a place that was meant to be a very democratic and a pretty radical form of education. There were to be no permanent faculty, no permanent student body, to award no degrees or certificates, and to be a place that really was about experimentation and discovery. And the school's maintained that ever since our founding.
So in the same way that some performers and artists are credited with expanding the limits of art or expanding the limits of music, some of the people at Haystack were expanding the limits of craft.
They were, and certainly in the early days of the school, in the 19 years of the exhibition chronicles, there were people who passed through Haystack, who would go on to radically redefine how a field was understood. There were people who were helping to rethink what it meant to make a weaving or what it meant to work in ceramics. And at the same time, there were people coming through the school that were also really intent on maintaining the sense of tradition and legacy that those mediums and disciplines were most closely connected to. And that's another area where I think the exhibition tells this beautiful story of both innovation and also in understanding that that innovation and that questioning came from a deep connection with a material and with a material's history. And so when one is thinking about, like, how far can you push ceramics, that's being pushed in relation to something, right? And so one of the things that we keep a very close eye on in running the school today is to make sure that we have programming that both acknowledges that rich history of craft and the place that it comes out of and the kind of discourse that it's connected to, as well as being really thoughtful about the ways that it can push outside of those more prescribed areas of understanding.
All right. Paul, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Paul Sakaridis is Executive Director of the Haystack Mountain School of Crafts. We'll start going to take some calls here in a moment, but I wanted to talk about the consumer side, the buyers, if you will. And I'm wondering, you know, there's always this talk about the accessibility of fine art to be, you know, affordable for people. Where do you think we are with respect to craft in this case? And I'll put it out to the group. Are the artists and creators making enough for what they're creating, and does it match what the consumers are willing to buy, to pay?
I would say so. This is Sadie. That craft is broadly, potentially more accessible than fine art. It has a really wide range of price points, and craft artists are making things that people use in their everyday life, so it may not be quite as big a decision, an aesthetic decision or a financial decision. It's easy to buy like a beautiful handmade mug for, say, under $50, under $20. And so there's all these items that people are making that people can use every day in addition to collector's items or items that might become a family heirloom.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that in some ways you have to just make distinguish between an object that's just a commodity and an object that has a little bit of a story behind it. I think that I see a lot of people making crafts and then trying to sell them, and in some ways trying to compete against that robot that built it for nothing. And that is, I find, to be a really challenging space to put somebody in the market. So I generally encourage people to really focus on the narrative of how this object came to be, and that a good part of what one is selling is that story. It's not just something that's produced by the thousands by a robot. This was something that I built myself.
1-800-399-3566. We'll go to the phones. We'll bring in Steve, who's calling from Lincoln. Hi, Steve.
Good afternoon. How are you folks today?
Good, thanks. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good. Great, thanks. Hey, I was wondering about including things like Maine's craft beer industry in this discussion. Of course, Portland is the number one craft beer city in the country. And then, of course, Maine is also the craft cannabis capital of the country, and certainly of the Northeast. And both of these products involve artisan input, stories behind the product. So what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, and food in general, I guess I would wonder about. We tend to think of objects, but do food and beer and liquors have a place in the craft world?
Yeah, I think that gets back into this discussion of, you know, what are we talking about when we talk about craft? And I think in some ways it has to do with a focus on the process and the materials and that story component that I was just talking about, that there's some specific concern for how this thing is created and the nuance of its creation that you'd find in craft X, whatever it is, that you don't find in just X.
Right.
Yeah, and the tradition of making, carrying tradition of transforming food and consuming it is certainly a part of that history. Yeah.
All right. We'll take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions, comments about craft in Maine. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Wayfinder Schools presenting Wine Our Way this Saturday at Willows Awake Winery. More information and tickets at wayfinderschools.org. On the next Speaking in Maine, migration from Guatemala to the U.S.
However bad the situation the Central Americans left behind, you should not assume that how they end up in the United States is necessarily better.
David Stoll is a professor of anthropology at Middlebury College who has worked with indigenous communities in Guatemala since the 1980s. He spoke at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport about the financial burden of migrating north. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Thursday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. A special thanks to Peter from Dresden for his donation of a 2003 Honda Odyssey. Donations to the Maine Public Car Donation Program make a big difference for your public radio station and in most cases result in a tax deduction for you. Towing is free, and the great feeling you get from supporting the programming that you enjoy and count on is priceless. If you're thinking of what to do with your car, please consider Maine Public. It's easy. Just visit mainepublic.org, click on support, and then the Maine Public Vehicle Donation Program. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the many different variations of crafts in Maine. My guests are Jason Ryan, founder and director at Open Bench Project. Daisy DeRossier is with the Lunder Institute for American Art, and Sadie Bliss is executive director of the Maine Crafts Association. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. Paul from Pownall writing, Jason can weigh in on this, but it seems to me that a ready distinction between craftspeople and makers is that with makers, the function of the end product is a central concern. This is why coding, electronics, and mechanics have been central to the maker movement. With any definitions, there are fuzzy edges. But in general, I think this is a useful and valid way of making the distinction.
Okay. sure. I mean, I'll reluctantly jump in on that, I suppose. I try really hard to avoid any sort of pigeonholing, just to allow everybody to be able to jump into it. But I guess that seems valid on its face. I wouldn't want to say that crafts don't have a function, but it does seem, in my mind at least, that the functionality of objects is, for everything that I've made, a big part of the story. And when I think about craft, I do tend to think about process and material and sort of careful considerations of those components, not so much about the... So yeah, sure, Paul, I think that's as good as any parsing line.
Okay. All right, let's go to Catherine in Pemaquid. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I am really excited about this Maine Calling episode because I represent the Good Supply in Pemaquid, which is an artist gallery representing 91 Maine artists. And every day I'm talking to our customers about valuing creative expression and creativity as human expression.
Mm-hmm. And you had in my notes here, you had something to say about technology having value.
Oh, and just hearing the conversation today has reinforced for me in today's culture when we relate innovation and technology, that's highly valued in our culture. And then there's something that's happened in the creative realm where human creativity has sort of been put on a cultural back burner. You know, we're talking about the Maker's Movement or sort of this line that's continued throughout human history, but again, just refocusing on these artists and makers have the propensity to follow through with their ideas and, again, to bring an idea into reality. And I think that has always been valuable for humankind. And I'm so happy that this is a thread that, you know, continues forth with such great support in the state of Maine.
Catherine, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Camden and Peter. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hello, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share with you quickly, if I might, we have an initiative that we're trying to get off the ground in Unity, Maine, that we're calling the Unity Agricultural Center. And essentially, it's going to be a large parcel of land that will be supporting a number of different agricultural businesses, farming businesses. And part of that initiative is to establish, which we have already started, a nonprofit that we're calling the Bowsprit Foundation. And the Bowsprit Foundation will be working with youth in need, 16 to 20-year-olds, and bringing them onto the farm, both to be involved in real kind of practical, important work in viable businesses. These are brief period intensive immersion programs that we'll be running. But part of that, we'll also be bringing in craft masters from around the Midcoast Maine and up along the Blue Hill Peninsula and so on that would come down and be guest faculty for our programs during this period. And I wanted to just bring that to everyone's attention that we're looking for investors and people to get involved in the project. The farm that we're under contract for is 500 acres in Unity. And we're kind of trying to spread the word and looking to build the nonprofit, which we have a board already and have filed with the state of Maine. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Great. Peter, thank you very much. While we're on the subject of sort of upcoming events, Sadie, there's also something this weekend that we probably want to mention.
Yeah, great. This weekend is Maine Craft Weekend. It's an annual statewide tour of Maine Craft studios, businesses, and events. So Maine Crafts Association serves as kind of the overarching umbrella organizer and promoter of it, but it's individual sites and individual people and artists all over the state creating these really amazing events and opening their doors and getting together and doing bigger events together. So if you go to the Maine Craft Weekend website, you can review them all and kind of plan a route. It's similarly structured to Maine Maple Weekend.
So, and there are a lot of these sort of person-to-person events, bringing people together, going into spaces. But I'm guessing that the internet has done a lot to find new markets and other useful ways of connecting artisans and crafts people. We sort of haven't really talked about that much, but is it, for example, how much do craftspeople depend on? We hear about Etsy a lot, but are there other ways that their creations can be shared and bought? And
certainly, I would say that social media is probably bigger and more important than Etsy or just a simple selling platform, because there's so much story sharing and kind of this online version of community building. I think everyone has a story of like learning about somebody on Instagram and seeing their life and seeing what they work and what their work is and what their studio looks like and eventually buying something from them.
Yeah.
But and also using those platforms to identify expertise, like we're talking a lot about object, but sometimes it's about looking for someone that, you know, a woodworker, blacksmith shop. So someone that has an expertise that could allow for a material conversation to happen where an idea becomes formed, because you're looking for someone who has that talent and is able to allow you to build that.
So what I'm getting from this is an important part of the piece of the creation is the story behind it, the person who made it, and why they were trying to do that. That's as much of the value or interest in the object as the object sitting there by itself.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely for me.
And that's why the community part is important, because that's how that gets known. Okay. Thank you. Let's go to Molly in Portland. Hi, Molly. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to respond to something Jason and Sadie both talked about earlier, and that's the idea of how beneficial it is for artists to come to have opportunities to come together and share ideas. I was a teacher at another point in my life, and I saw what that happens when kids in a classroom collaborate on ideas. And it has, I just wanted to share something wonderful that has happened to me as an artist. I live and work in the same building that my studio is in, and I don't get out much. I work in isolation, as I think a lot of artists do. And a few years ago, a very small group of artists in my immediate neighborhood got together and founded a little guild as a means of supporting one another. There were about four or five of us in the beginning. There are now over 35 of us, and most of us all live, work, and create in this same little Rosemont neighborhood in Portland. We call ourselves the Rosemont Artist Guild, and we meet as a large group four or five times a year to share ideas and plan events. But we also meet in smaller groups more frequently to just inspire and encourage each other and talk about ideas that we have. We have a website. A couple of us work with students in our studios, young students, mentoring them and working on community art projects. And so I just want to encourage others, other craftspeople who might feel kind of isolated out there, to look at organizations like the Maine Craft Association and to look at maker spaces, and because being part of a larger community has meant so much to me.
All right, Molly, thanks very much for joining us. I did have it in my notes to Sadie, and maybe you can comment on this, that some artisans, crafters, for example, in apparel, face the same kind of challenges that other businesses do, that is a worker shortage. And in my notes, I see something about not enough sewers, for example, for apparel makers. Is that a thing? Is that a problem here?
Yeah, in that particular sort of subset in craft, it is. And that might be talking about a little bit of a bigger shop where there's a designer and they need kind of a small staff. And there's just some interesting things happening in the apparel industry in Maine, and there's a lot of overlap with craft. And it's also interesting because it's kind of not exactly craft either, this other kind of business thread. But
well, that's what I wonder, is this part of the controversy as a business grows and needs more
And it can also be that the person who's the sewer, who's not part of the design and just is kind of working a 9-to-5 job, kind of wonder sort of where do they fit into the craft world. But there is, in Maine there is a lack of sewers, and there's been some at American Roots is an apparel company that actually started their own training program for the sewers because they didn't exist.
All right, let's go to Bill. Bill, I'm not sure where you're calling from, but you're on the program. Welcome.
This is Bill Serretta, Fork Food Labs, Portland, Maine.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Putting in a plug for the food piece again, I was talked about a bit earlier. We have 45 artisans, all small, and they're really small businesses, part-time, and some of them are actually now working full-time. But they all make their food from scratch. Most of them use local inputs, and they're all pretty passionate about what they do. And we have a range of ages, backgrounds, professions, and products that get made. And I think it was mentioned just a minute ago about that collaboration aspect. What's fascinating about a space, any type of collaborative space, is the sharing that goes on. And in our case, it's sharing of recipes, sharing of packaging ideas, sharing of how to create your logo. All of those get played out in the workspace on any given day. And actually more support probably comes from member to member than it does from our ability as a shared kitchen food business incubator to provide that on a more structured basis. And I think it becomes a pretty important aspect. All of these programs become a pretty important aspect of the economic development of Maine and creating businesses and jobs that might not otherwise be here if these spaces did not exist.
Yeah. Okay, Bill. Thanks very much. And while we're in the business of plugging, I want to give the panel the last minute here to talk about anything that they want the listeners to know. Jason, is there anything?
Sure. We have, speaking of Maine Craft Weekend, we have an open house on Saturday, Saturday afternoon, if anybody wants to swing by our shop and check out what we're up to. We're usually around from 1 to 4. Doors are open. Plenty of friendly folks to chat.
Okay.
And I'll be there. I'll stop by for a visit.
Yeah. And Daisy, you wanted to share something as well.
Well, I just wanted to reiterate that as we're building this interactive map, it's really a tool to facilitate networking between visiting artists that we're hosting on campus, local artists, for them to find a Maine-based material expert, craft people. And so if any woodworker, metalworker, potter, glassblower are interested, please reach out to us, lunderinstitute@colby.edu.
And that launches at the end of November.
Hopefully, yes.
Hopefully,
on good track, yes.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Sadie, anything else you mentioned this weekend? Anything else on the radar?
Yeah, if you haven't stopped into our Maine Crafts Association retail gallery and resource centers, we have one in Portland called Maine Craft Portland right across from Mecca, and we have the Center for Craft in West Gardner. And those are great places to, we say, visit, shop, and learn about Maine Craft.
All right, Sadie, Daisy, Jason, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sadie Bliss is Executive Director of the Maine Crafts Association. Daisy Desrosiers is Program Director for the Lunder Institute for American Art. And Jason Ryan, Founder and Director at Open Bench Project. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.